Member FDIC.
Federal weather forecasters say the La Nina weather pattern now developing could produce an active Atlantic hurricane season this year. Historically, a La Nina means less rain in the south, a mild spring and summer in the north, and fewer hurricanes in the Pacific Ocean. A hailstorm at Cape Canaveral yesterday pummeled the space shuttle, damaging it badly enough for NASA officials to cancel its March 15th launch date. NASA says it will take at least until April to make necessary repairs. A breakthrough scientific study say antioxidant vitamins do not live up to their claim that they will extend the lives of the millions of people who take them. At least 10% of Americans and Europeans take antioxidants, spending more than $2 billion annually. Despite warnings from economists about the country's financial future, consumer confidence surged this month to its highest level in more than 5 years. Analysts say consumers will continue to use their buying power to fuel the nation's economy. Consumer spending is responsible for two-thirds of the nation's economic activity. Airbus will meet with worker unions today to announce plans to eliminate 10,000 jobs in four European countries. The world's second-largest aircraft maker says it will ask its contractors to share the impact of job losses. Light sweet crude is trading at $60.07 a barrel on the New York Mercantile Exchange. And on Wall Street at this hour, the Dow Jones is up 90, the NASDAQ is up 16, and the S&P 500 is up 12. There's more at QualityNewsNetwork.com. I'm Jay Gallet.
And now, from Washington, the Inside Scoop. All the news the government does not want you to hear. Now, here's your host on the Inside Scoop, Mark Levine.
Good afternoon, America. Welcome to the Inside Scoop. Well, they said it couldn't last, and it didn't. The Dow Jones Industrial Average dropped 416 points yesterday. Apparently, China had something going wrong. They had been told that they were going to investigate illegal stock activities there. That sent their market down 9%, set our market down 3%. But what does it all mean? I mean, what does it matter whether the Dow Jones goes up or down? Most Americans don't own stock. Who does make the money when Wall Street goes up and down? How does Wall Street work? And what does yesterday's stock market collapse tell us about the economy and its future? Well, to help answer these questions, my guest today is Doug Henwood. He's the author of three books, The New Economy, The Street, and The State of the USA Atlas. Doug Henwood, welcome to the Inside Scoop.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Well, let me ask you, Doug, yesterday's stock market collapse, was this a surprise? Was this something that couldn't be predicted, or is this par for the course?
Well, it all depends upon what it is. Sometimes markets have these seizures that last a day or two, and or even just a couple of weeks, and they don't really matter for much in the longer term. Sometimes, though, when you have a real serious market panic, it is the beginning of broader economic problems. So it's really too early to tell which this is. Certainly, it could have been predicted. There are plenty of, as the official didn't like to say, imbalances in the economy. There's this really weird symbiotic relation between the U.S. and China, in which we import a lot of stuff from them, and they lend us the money to do it. And for both countries, this has been working pretty well all along, but it just doesn't look like something you can do forever.
The weird thing about with China is we borrow their money, so we take money from them, and with their own money, we buy their goods. So all we end up with is a huge amount of debt.
That's basically what it is. As a Clinton economic advisor, Laura Tyson, put it a couple of years ago, Asia lends and America spends. And that's been driving the world economy now for the last, well, it's been quite a while, but it really has entered a new intense phase for the last 4 or 5 years. So
are we living on borrowed time? I mean, is this just something that has to, by its nature, collapse? Is this the beginning of something that could be much, much worse?
Well, it could be. It could be, certainly. I tend to get nervous around the word collapse because, you know, people have predicted disasters that have never materialized, and I try to avoid the chicken little problem. But it is something that can't go on forever. The United States has got a current account deficit, which means it's not just the trade deficit, but also on the financial side, where you're just spending more than we earn. We're, you know, living beyond our means. We can have all kinds of homey metaphors to express that, but that's what it boils down to. The U.S. is just living beyond its means and borrowing the difference. The numbers are just getting huge because the U.S. economy is so large. roughly a quarter of the world economy, the numbers just get, we're sucking up vast shares of the world's savings, and we're not investing it productively. We're just buying stuff with it. It's financed our housing bubble, which is now deflating. It's financed consumer electronics boom, you know, all the widescreen TVs, people spending $3,000 or $4,000 on a TV. Maybe financed with home equity loans. So the whole model on which the American economy has been running for the last 20, 25 years, but again, it's entered a really bizarre phase in the last four or five, just doesn't seem like it's a prudent way to manage an economy over the longer term. But everyone has a stake in keeping it going because the alternative is kind of hard to contemplate. Now, you can imagine some sort of slow adjustment that takes years, which means slower growth of consumption, slower job growth, wage growth, slower economic growth in the U.S., slower than the rest of the world, so things get gradually into balance, or there could be some sort of bone-crunching financial panic that makes the adjustment.
I mean, Doug, our political leaders seem to want us to spend. I mean, after September 11th, George Bush said, don't sacrifice, don't go without, we're going to fight a war. And I want you to keep buying those TVs. In fact, you can show your patriotism by going into deep, deep debt. In fact, I'll lead the way to the largest budget deficit in American history. These pro-debt policies by Republicans that claim to be fiscal conservatives but obviously aren't, where do they come from and where are they leading us?
Well, part of the problem is, you know, wage growth in the U.S., aside from the late 1990s, the average worker has seen, after you adjust for inflation, no wage increases or actual wage declines for most of the last 25 years. There was a period in the late 1990s where there were across-the-board wage increases. But aside from that, since it's actually more than 30 years, since 1973, the average real wage has just been declining in most years. And in better years, it's just been flat. If you look at average household incomes, they're actually lower now than they were 5 years ago. So the average person, and I'm even if we can take this up to, you know, maybe the 80th percentile of the income distribution, the people, you know, the bottom 80% of the population has not been doing well in this economy. The top 10% has been doing well, and the top 1% has been doing spectacularly well. That's where all the economic gains of economic growth have been going for the last 4 or 5 years.
So basically, we're borrowing money to finance the way we used to live as our wages fall. Is that fair?
Exactly,
for the 80%
people
of us?
Borrow either to maintain the appearance of a middle-class standard of living because they have to just to buy necessities. If you look what's happened with that, with housing prices, it's always strange to me that, you know, it's considered a healthy housing market when prices are rising rapidly. Housing is one of the essentials of life, so to see its price rising rapidly means that, you know, shelter is being priced out of the reach of ordinary people. So we've seen a tremendous housing bubble in certain parts of the United States over the last several years, and people have had to take out extremely large mortgages with very dubious interest rate arrangements, and that all looks to be catching up with us now. Like I said, we don't know what the adjustment could take, be spread out over years. It wouldn't be so traumatic. It could happen overnight, of this, you know, several days or weeks of what we saw yesterday, extrapolated into the future. That could happen, but something's got to give. This is not a prudent way to run an economy on this much borrowing and this much foreign debt.
Now, of course, this is a political show, and my question for you is, I mean, the Bush tax cuts, of course, did take money, at least percentage-wise, from the poor and give it to the rich. You mentioned there was some wage growth in the late 1990s under Bill Clinton. I understand Bill Clinton didn't exactly stem the tide of falling real wages, but was there better income equality, say, 6 years ago than over the last 6 years?
Yeah, I mean, there were a lot of strange things about the 1990s boom. It was, you know, driven by the crazy dot-com bubble, and, you know, in many ways it just was the U.S. economy was running beyond its speed limit. But the fact that the unemployment rate fell below 4% and stayed there for a while meant that people across the income distribution, I mean, from people way at the bottom to people at the top, men, women, black, white, Hispanic, almost everyone, saw good income gains in the late 1990s. That is really the only time in the last 30 years that's been true. This time, the last several years, we've seen great gains at the very, very top of the heap and nothing for just about everyone else.
And of course, in the midst of all this debt with China and our falling wages, we have huge more debt by this Iraq war. I saw one pundit write in today's newspaper that it could cost up to $2 trillion by 2017. I have no idea if that figure is even in the ballpark, but that's, our national debt used to be under $2 trillion just a few years ago, and now we're going to spend that much on a single war. At the end of the day, we have to pay this stuff back. Now, how does that happen?
Well, I think the estimate you're probably referring to an estimate that comes from Joseph Stiglitz, who is a Nobel Prize winning economist. So
pretty good estimate then.
Yeah, so he knows what he's doing, and he did it in collaboration with a public finance expert. So this is very solid stuff.
Okay.
There's no way a government ever has to pay off its debt as long as it's just in control and not too large. Governments can keep rolling over their debt. You know, first world governments, you know, like U.S., Japan, Western Europe, you know, they don't really have to worry. It's not like a business. Where the business may someday hit a financial crisis or have to worry about going out of business. Countries don't go bankrupt the way businesses do. So it's not really entirely proper to bring that model.
First world countries don't go bankrupt.
What'd you say?
I was going to say first world countries don't go bankrupt.
No. Certainly third world countries do, but first world countries don't. Certainly the third world went through a lot of hell in its debt crisis in the 80s and early 90s, but that just doesn't apply to a country like the United States or Japan. Or, you know, Japan had a terrible economy during the 1990s, and you know, it really, the pain was not all that great. So there's a certain level of development means you've got a pretty good cushion. But what it means is that all this money we're spending on the war and all the money we're spending on debt service to finance the war means that the government can't do other things. So it's going to be cutbacks in civilian spending, cutbacks in medical spending, cutbacks in environmental spending. All the stuff that, the good stuff the government can do is getting crowded out, and it's being all our resources being driven to upper income tax cuts, debt service, which goes mainly to upper income bondholders, and war making. So this is what the priorities of the U.S. government are now. It's just making the rich richer and fighting wars, and healing the environment and healing sick people is just going to go out the window.
We have to take a break, folks. If you want to join in this discussion or ask our illustrious guest any question you want about the U.S. economy, the stock market, anything you like, toll-free number is 888-488-MARK, 877-4-HEAD-ON. Call either number. They both work the same. When we come back, I'm going to bring this back to Wall Street and try to figure out how Wall Street affects your ordinary American. We'll be right back after this.
The United Brotherhood of Carpenters and Millwrights are problem solvers. They accept any challenge and approach every project with the highest of competency and training. UBC has thousands of professionals who can be at your service, giving you the best in business anytime and every time. It's their job to provide manpower. They build partnerships based on respect and trust. They provide skilled, responsible millwrights and carpenters to meet the challenge of any project because they believe and what they're doing and are so very committed to getting each and every job done right. They include a clause in your contract that eliminates work slowdown and jurisdictional disputes because they believe that, as professionals, they can discuss and solve any problem while keeping your project on target on time. We'd like to take this opportunity to thank the men and women of the United Brotherhood of Carpenters and Millwrights for building the American dream and saving the American dream. Thank you.
Do you believe the environment is issue number one? Does the idea of genetically modified food cause you to lose your appetite? Do you prefer green over greed? Do rising sea levels and vanishing polar ice cause you concern about our planet and what we are doing to it? Would you like news with attitude on the environment, organics, renewable sources of energy? Well, then join me, John Fox, for Foxed Up. Weekdays 5 p.m. Eastern, 2 p.m. Pacific, 10 p.m. in the UK, and 9 a.m. here in Sydney, where conversation radio becomes conservation radio, and we turn it straight up to 11, right here on the Head On Radio Network.
Thank you. There's a place where a total stranger will give their blood to save your life. There's a place where someone you never knew will save your child from drowning. A place where people will give you food and shelter after a flood. There's a place where, when you need it most, someone will reach out their hand, put it across your shoulder and say, "Everything's going to be okay." That place is called America, where we look out for each other. And it's up to us to keep it that way. When you help the American Red Cross, you help America. Call 1-800-RED-CROSS or visit redcross.org today.
From Washington, more of the Inside Scoop with Mark Levine.
Welcome back to the Inside Scoop. We're talking about the stock market, Wall Street, and the economy with my guest, Doug Henwood, the author of The New Economy, The Street, and The State of the USA Atlas. Doug, why do you know so much about Wall Street? What's your take? Where does that come from?
My first job out of college was on Wall Street briefly. I ended up going to graduate school after that, but I've been watching the thing for quite a number of years.
What did you do on Wall Street? Were you like a trader?
I was actually just the assistant to a chairman of this small options firm back in the days when listed options were young in 1975, 76.
Very Wall Street from today, isn't it?
Oh, it's quite different, yeah. I just watch it closely. I read a lot. I talk to a lot of people. I'm not directly a participant in the shenanigans that go on there.
Maybe that's why you can criticize it fairly.
Fear, fascination, relation with Wall Street for the last 30 years of my life.
So what does Wall Street mean, other than being, more fun gambling than Vegas, perhaps, with slightly better odds? Why does it really matter? It seems to me that Wall Street has very little to do with real economics sometimes. I mean, I know the theory. I mean, I'm an economics major myself. I know the theory, raising equity capital and people put a lot of money in to make companies run and so forth. But it seems that the money all seems to just get sucked out by the CEO, who gets paid a la Tyco or Enron or Disney, whether he does a good job or not. So what's wrong? Why isn't the theory matching reality?
Most people think that, that's Wall Street raises money for companies, and it certainly does that. But that's a small, very small portion of what it does. In the aggregate, actually, Wall Street operates in the reverse. It takes money out of real companies and gives it to shareholders. There's been not just regular dividends, but through takeovers and share buybacks, companies have been spending on just shoveling out a very large portion of their profits over the last 20 years to their shareholders. So
that's not a bad thing, is it?
Exactly the opposite of what the textbooks say.
But that's not a bad thing, is it? I mean, to give the profits. I'd rather the shareholders get it than the CEOs, frankly.
Well, yeah, but what do the shareholders contribute? They haven't contributed money to the company. What we've seen over the last 25 years or so, as Wall Street has gotten to be larger and larger and more influential in the real economy, is a demand for very, very high levels of profitability achieved in a very short period of time. Stockholders are extremely impatient, and they want companies to just give them the money rather than spending it on their underlying operations. So we've seen in this expansion that began in 2001, we've seen very low levels of real investment. Companies have spent very little on equipment and buildings and things like that. And a very slow rate of employment generation. And this is what Wall Street likes to see. They want the money. They don't want companies to spend it on their underlying businesses unless they have a pretty good shot at a very, very high rate of profit. So
it's a short-term versus long-term problem. People are looking for the next profit around the corner, and they're not investing in 10, 20, 30 years from now. Is that the problem?
Yeah, that's basically it. Now, we've seen this trend towards private equity in the last few years. That is large buyout funds, this TXU deal that hit the news the other day. These large private equity groups have been taking companies private, and they say as they're doing that, the PR is that they can focus on the long term. Now, I'm not sure that that's what they really want to do, but this is an implicit admission that public companies, the ones that trade on the stock market, do not focus on the long term. They don't have that luxury. They've always got some stock analyst or trader breathing down their neck, or maybe some corporate raider who wants to do something to them. So the market maintains a constant, intense discipline on companies to be as profitable as they can, as quickly as they can.
Let me go to the phone line. Sarge from Mississippi, welcome to the Inside Scoop.
Yes, how are you doing today, Mark?
Doing good. How are you?
Pretty good. I do have a question for your guest.
Please.
I have a trust fund at a local bank here, and my trust officer a couple of weekends ago was in Memphis at a conference where the speaker was Alan Greenspan, and it was at the Peabody Motel in Memphis, and Greenspan has really docked the economic plans of the Bush administration. I don't know if your guest has heard his latest remarks on it and all, but I'd kind of like to...
He said we're headed for recession, as I recall.
Yeah, I believe that's what the phrase he used.
He used the R word, which yes. Some say was part of the reason for the collapse yesterday. In addition to the Chinese.
And I wanted to throw that out to him and see, hear his comments. I'm going to hang up and let him go.
Well, what's your question, Sarge? You want to know what he thinks about Greenspan,
yeah,
or is it more specific?
I want to see what he thinks about Greenspan's statements of late about his being negative about the economic future.
Okay.
Of this economic.
Got it. Plan. Got it. Fair question. All right, Doug, tell us what you think about Alan Greenspan in general, yeah. And then about the recent comments.
Yeah, pardon my cynicism, but Greenspan's speaking fee is about $150,000 a pop, although others have paid him up to $250,000. And I think, you know, he's a...
That's not bad for one speech.
Not bad for a speech, no, and if you, you know, give 30 of them, you're really racking in the money.
That's true.
But, you know, his reign at the Fed is getting to be a more and more distant memory, and I think he wants to keep his name in the news, so he has to say something that attracts attention. And saying that we're heading for a recession is something that certainly did attract a lot of attention. His argument, though, was kind of insubstantial. He just said it's been a long time since the last one, so we're due for one sometime. That's basically...
Business cycle. It's got to happen.
Yeah, so certainly that's true, but whether it's this year, next year, or the year after, we don't really know. I don't really understand why Greenspan has such a glorious reputation. This guy, if you look at his record, he came into office, there was a dollar crisis, a stock market crash, the final binge of the leveraging mania of the 80s, the death rattle of the savings and loans, a very long period of flatness, slump in the early 1990s, the jobless recovery. We had the Asian crisis, the Russian crisis, the Mexican crisis. We had a stock market bubble, and then another long period of weak economy and jobless recovery in the early part of this decade, and the beginning of a housing bubble, which is now unraveling and apparently doing some damage to the real economy. So I don't understand why he's so greatly revered. It was not an unblemished record.
Well, you know, but if you look at sort of inflation and unemployment, what I think it was Ronald Reagan first termed the misery index, those have been relatively low over the past 20 years. Doesn't he get some credit for that?
Oh, yeah, I'm not quite sure what he contributed to that. He was there was that tech boom in the late 1990s, which is what really gave us the good unemployment numbers, and that was unsustainable. I mean, it fell apart. We had a collapse.
Well, he called it irrational exuberance, so I mean, kind of hard to blame him for that bubble.
Well,
right?
He actually used that phrase in, I think, December 96 or 97.
Yeah, and then it went up again for four more years.
He actually got pummeled so hard by Congress and the pundits that he never said anything like that again. Didn't say anything publicly about the stock market for about 6 months after he said that. And then he started shaking the pom-poms and cheerleading the bull market on. And he completely turned it around.
I'll give you my biggest beef with Alan Greenspan, and it has to do with when I first started working in Congress in 2001. And here it was, we had, for the first time in really since the 60s, we had surplus after surplus and growing to the largest surplus ever in American history. I mean, by far, by real and in percentage terms. And with surpluses, as far as the eye could see, Greenspan said he was worried that the surpluses would end up paying off all of our debt and that we would not know where to put the money, and therefore he supported George Bush's tax cuts to the super rich. And I remember thinking at that time, you know, Mr. Greenspan, when we pay off our debt, we can worry about that then. But he sounded to me like
people, you know.
Yeah, exactly. He sounded to me like kind of like the opposite of Joseph in the Bible, who was worried about, you know, stocking up for the good times. He's worried about too much good times, and what are we going to do then? You know, it was almost kind of reverse Cassandra, and I think it's because obviously he wanted to play nice to the new president and support his tax cuts.
That's, yeah, two things about that. First of all, a Federal Reserve chair is not supposed to offer political advice like that. It's not
exactly.
And second of all, you know, even though it makes no sense for us to run surpluses forever, I think what he wanted to do was to have enough of a squeeze on the federal budget so that we could they could say, well, we can't afford such and such civilian program. We can't afford to spend money on the environment. We can't afford to spend the money on health care. We can't afford to spend the money on education. So we can afford to spend money on war and incarceration, but just don't spend it on any humane things. So that's
Ronald Reagan's old strategy. The idea was that if you go into huge, huge debt, then you can cut social programs. Then we could say, well, we got to have the money for defense. We got to have the money for war. But sorry, we're going to have to cut Social Security. We're going to have to cut Medicare and education. And of course, before September 11th, Greenspan didn't see any way. So we manufactured a crisis with our tax cuts, and then of course came George Bush's wars, and now we're deep, deep debt. But that's my particular beef.
No, I think there's a lot of truth to that. It's you know, the first time you can be excused for not realizing the trick, but the second time around, you know, we've been here before. We should have realized what was going on, but it just happened.
The toll-free number is 888-488-MARK or 877-4-HEAD-ON. We welcome your calls for our esteemed guest. You can also get his book, by the way. There's a link to it on my website, RadioInsideScoop.com. You can even download the book on your computer for free. I don't know what a Wall Street guy is doing, giving away anything for free, but we'll talk about that, Doug, after the break. 877-4-HEAD-ON. We'll be right back after this.
Sweetie, I love you, but those jeans have got to go.
Yeah, I know. Grab me a pair next time you go to the store, would you?
No.
Uh-huh.
I'm not going there anymore. I can't stand it.
What do you mean?
It's just awful, honey. The only smile in that building is that big yellow face. Everybody else looks miserable, and I can't find anything there that's made in our country. That bothers me.
Well, nobody makes clothes in America anymore.
Au contraire, mi amigo. There's a ton of American-made clothing at No Sweat.
Well, where's this No Sweat store? Out at the mall?
No, silly. I found them at HeadOnRadioNetwork.com. There's a link there. I already ordered some great workout gear, and I also got you some new jeans. They'll be here in a couple of days. Surprise.
HeadOnRadioNetwork.com?
Uh-huh. Just click on the No Sweat banner. You're right there. Helps union workers and helps support America's other liberal network. Cool, huh?
I knew listening to the horn was a good idea.
Whose idea?
Your idea, dear. All the good ones are.
Union made? No sweat. Great prices? No sweat. Great looks? No sweat. No sweat at HeadOnRadioNetwork.com. Click the banner. Do the right thing.
What's a conversation like on Head On with Bob Kincaid? This is what it's like.
Let's go. Let's talk to our good friend Phil down in Daytona Beach, Florida. Hey, Phil, welcome to the program. Good to hear from you.
Thanks, Bob. Good to hear you, too. I want to remind people that the military take an oath to support and defend the Constitution. And when people say they're fighting for our freedom by defending the Constitution, which defines our freedoms and supposedly is there to protect them, that's what it really means. Not doing whatever this outrageous civilian leadership dictates that it does.
Head On with Bob Kincaid. Conversation at its finest. Weeknights, Monday through Friday, 6 to 9 p.m. Eastern Time. Only at Head On Radio Network and chat at HeadOnRadioNetwork.com.
Hi, this is Sarah Jessica Parker. It's hard to believe that 1.5 million people in New York City are at risk of going hungry. More than half of them are children and the elderly. The Food Bank for New York City provides the food that soup kitchens, food pantries, and shelters use to feed those in need. Now more than ever, we need your help in the fight against hunger. For more information, visit the Food Bank at www.foodbanknyc.org.
California's adult education system is proudly celebrating 150 years of success. I'm Jack O'Connell, State Superintendent of Public Instruction. As a teacher of adult learners, I ask you to join me in celebrating this important milestone. Each year, adult education helps nearly 1.5 million Californians become better literate citizens, high school graduates, fluent in English, or ready for college. To learn more about adult education in your community, contact your local school district.
From Washington, back to the Inside Scoop with Mark Levine.
Welcome back to the Inside Scoop. We're discussing yesterday's stock market fall and the state of the economy in general, how it works, how Wall Street works, and what we might expect to see in the future with my guest, Doug Henwood. He's the author of The New Economy, The Street, and the State of the USA Atlas. You can buy his books or even download them by the link that I provide on my website at radioinsidescoop.com. Hey, Doug, how come an analyst of Wall Street's giving books away? What's the deal?
Well, the publisher let it go out of print, and that meant the rights reverted to me. The book is about 10 years old, and so it would need substantial updating to make it into a viable commercial product again.
Okay.
So I just put it up on the web, and there is a PayPal button there if people want to make a contribution. I've actually made almost as much from those as I did from the publisher's original advance. So
Interesting. Some people believe it's worthwhile to pay for books, and sometimes you can actually get more from people who believe in you. I'll tell you that my listeners are already saying very good things about you, and I've got one of those listeners on the line, Dave from California. Welcome to the Inside Scoop.
Hey, Mark and Doug. Mark is voicing much of my concerns for me here, but I don't know your views as I'm listening to it. You're laying out a lot of scholarly information, but it is my belief that the administration presently in power is totally out to exploit the working people, the middle class, and the poor, and to act in favor, to benefit a very wealthy, very greedy, exploited class of folks. And is that a good thing as you're seeing it, or am I seeing it wrong?
I think that's there's a lot of truth to observation. I think that despite a lot of lip service the Republicans and Bush in particular pay to the middle classes, the middle classes have gotten nothing out of the Bush years, and the plutocrats have gotten lots and lots out of the Bush years. Certainly the plutocrats did very well during the Clinton years, but the rest of the population did pretty well, too. Now we're just seeing the plutocrats thriving and everyone else hoping that a few crumbs will fall from the elegant tables that they could catch.
Now, Doug, I mean, I've been saying this really for many, many years now. Before the radio show, I used to say it in Congress. It was very obvious to me. I mean, you clearly hear people about John Edwards, for example, talks about the two societies. Do you think that the average American is getting it? Because I meet a lot of people, middle class, upper middle class. I'm not talking about the top 1%, but certainly the bottom 80%. And they're not all Christian fundamentalists either. They seem to think that, I got $300 off my taxes. I'm doing okay. The question is, do Americans get it economically? And if not, why not?
You know, it just sure doesn't seem that way. I don't understand why people. It's hard to say. I think the income level at which white people start voting Republican is around $26,000.
$26,000. That's just over the poverty line.
Yeah. So I think there's some kind of racial angle to it. That to some degree the Republican Party represents the party of white supremacy in some minds. So that's one possibility.
I'm just curious. If you take out the Christian fundamentalists and look at white non-Christian fundamentalists, I would have to think that goes up much higher than 26,000.
Oh, I think you're probably right. I think you're absolutely right about that. There's no doubt that the Christian fundamentalists, right-wing Christian fundamentalists, represent about, 30% of the electorate, maybe even more. So they have a pretty big influence on the outcomes. In the 2004 election, the two best predictors of what people's party vote was race, black people voting Democrat, and frequent church attendance. Frequent church attendance meant people were almost certain to vote Republican. So that kind of, you know, that hardcore Christian right influence is very, very large. But it just doesn't make any sense.
Talk about, you know, the soccer moms who were apparently the electorate of choice in one of these election years. I forget which one was the soccer mom year. But when you talk about them, you're thinking of, you know, married white people, not necessarily, maybe churchgoers, but not necessarily, you know, evolution doesn't exist kind of churchgoers. I guess one of the things that I find interesting, and I debate Republicans all the time. I do it on my show. I do it live. Is they don't ever talk about the debt, and they say, well, hey, you got less, you paid less taxes, as if we weren't recognizing that, you know, we're going into the deep debt plus interest on the debt. I don't know. I mean, I just don't have any ideas on how to convey that to people, that just because you pay a few pennies less now doesn't mean you're not going to suffer later.
Well, I used to think that, you know, if you just got the rational arguments out there and the facts out there, that things would get straightened out. But I don't know. I think people really. A lot of politics is about fantasy and misperception, and it's not rational, and it's not fact-based. And it's very, very hard to penetrate people's misperceptions and fantasies. I mean, 75% of Bush voters in 2004 thought he supported the Kyoto Protocol. I mean, what does that mean? I mean, this most anti-environmental.
Do most Americans know what the Kyoto Protocol is?
I mean, you and I do, and
frankly, I'm not. Let's just in case my listeners are pretty sophisticated, but just in case you don't know, folks, that was the one to cut down on emissions worldwide and protecting the environment. I would bet you the majority of Americans maybe have heard of it, but couldn't even tell you what it was.
You may be right, but
they just think it sounds good, so therefore my guy supports it.
Although Kyoto, that's a foreign country. I mean,
yeah. Maybe it's not a good thing. Hey, maybe the 25% didn't like it.
But I think people just don't make connections between policies and parties and candidates. It's just and the level of coverage of politics, you know, in the media is just it's so childish, and it's all in the horse race. Where here we are, you know, something. It's early.
But Doug, don't you want to hear about Britney Spears' haircut and Anna Nicole Smith's love child?
Well, actually, I kind of enjoy that stuff. So I have nothing against that. But I mean, I wish they would do a better job covering the. You know, it's early 2007. The election is 20 months away, and we're deep in the presidential campaign. But
right.
We don't really know very much about what any of these guys stand for. We just get a lot of it's personalities. You know, the David Geffen incident and all that.
Yeah, we're not even talking about the new Democratic Congress, which we've worked so hard, at least. My side of the aisle has worked so hard to get, and I'm curious to know what they're going to do. I'm frankly willing to press them a bit to do what I consider to be the right things. This to me is the politics of what should be 2007 instead of a comment of David Geffen.
Yeah, and you know, we also have this public is turning more and more against the war in Iraq, and Congress, a lot of the Democrats in Congress are having trouble finding their voice in doing something about that.
Yeah, they're a little scared.
They're so afraid of being portrayed as unpatriotic or betraying the troops or whatever, that they're just they've lost their voices. And the public now, it's more than half of the public now in the latest poll I saw wants to set a deadline for getting out. So the public is getting stronger in its opposition to the war, but there seems to be some disconnect when we get to the level of Congress.
Well, I guess that's why I want to get back to this grand debt question, because I realize that most Americans, at least certainly those in the elite, don't have their sons and daughters and cousins fighting. It tends to be a class thing, not exclusively. But they should, I would think, care about the debt. I mean, $2 trillion, that's a huge amount of money. You can't even picture that amount of money. Why aren't the Democrats or somebody else, maybe even fiscal conservatives, heck, maybe even the Heritage Foundation, give Cato a call, talking about this huge debt? And even though, as you point out, first world countries don't really go bankrupt, how will this debt affect us over the next 5, 10, 20 years?
Well, I just remember this administration that sent 360 tons of cash to Iraq and didn't keep any records of how they distributed it. So
They misplaced it.
Yeah.
You know, it fell out of their pocket. You know, I carry 360 tons every day. I mean, it's a part of my workout. So,
yeah,
well, you know, I misplace it. It happens.
Muscle, yeah.
It's a lot of muscle.
But, you know, I think the public debt is a problem, but also the private debt is a tremendous problem. You know, we've been incurring
Tell us about
all
that.
These debts, household debts, huge amounts of mortgage debt over the last.
Are we at an all-time high in terms of private debt as a percentage of the economy?
Well, the mortgage debt, yes. It's just off the charts.
So everyone's living. I mean, the whole bottom 80% is living on borrowed time, I guess.
Well, home equity loans. It's been really the juice. A quarter to a half the economic growth over the last 5 years has come from has been housing related, related to the housing bubble. People have borrowed about $2 trillion in home equity over the last 5 years. So it's just huge amounts of money. Most of that financing, since we have almost no domestic savings to speak of anymore, most of that money has come from abroad, and that most of that money that's come from abroad has come from the central banks of China and Japan and Korea and India and Russia.
Saudi Arabia's probably got a good chunk, I would think.
So you know, this is just it's a very, very serious problem. You know, even if it doesn't end up in some kind of bone-crunching crisis, it's a very reckless way to run an economy. Having all these debts, being so dependent upon the inflow of $2 or $3 billion every business day to keep the economy humming, it's an extremely imprudent way to run things because there's just no margin for error. If you experience any kind of shock, then you're really in deep trouble.
So, Doug, what happens when it stops, sort of when the merry-go-round stops and we're all dizzy? You know, it's okay when you're on the ride, but when it stops, you get dizzy and you fall off. If the Chinese decide, for whatever reason, you know, maybe they go after Taiwan and then we decide to defend Taiwan and they decide, sorry, we're not going to help you anymore. If the money flow stops, what happens to us when the merry-go-round stops? I mean, are we flying off?
Well, you know, the Chinese have an interest in perpetuating this because they do hold $1 trillion and they don't want that to lose value. So they're kind of on the hook.
So our threat to default on them is actually a counterweight.
Yeah, you know,
I forgot who it was that said that if you're poor and you're in debt, the bank owns you, but if you're rich and you're in debt, you own the bank, kind of thing.
That's true. There's a lot of versions of that saying, but it's still very true. But, you know, if you look at the United States, if the United States were an ordinary country, it looks very much like Thailand did in 1997. It's a huge foreign debt problem, speculative elements in the financial markets and the economy, just living beyond its means. You would think that if the United States were a small, poor country, the IMF would be on its doorstep prescribing a structural adjustment program. The United States obviously is not a small, poor country. So what happens? Now, the normal thing for a country like the United States, if it were one of those small, ordinary countries, would be a round of severe belt tightening, a deliberately provoked recession that would slow down demand for imports, increase exports, and just put the books back into balance through some sort of imposed near depression. That's what Mexico went through in 1994. That's what Southeast Asia went through in 1997. And that's what, you know, orthodox financial types would prescribe for a country that, you know, you just looked at the numbers of the United States and abstracted away the political power of the United States, then that's what would be in order for this country. But, you know, this is not an ordinary country. You know, we're used to giving orders to the rest of the world. We're not used to receiving orders from international bankers. So I don't know how this sort of thing resolves itself. It's just very, very dangerous. If there's any kind of problem, if the Chinese, you know, the Chinese economy has been booming for 20 years. Countries don't, you know, economies don't boom without interruption for 20 years. Something's got to give.
It's unstable in the sense that we have a dictatorship there. I mean, I would think at some point the Chinese, at least, you know, Japan is a democracy. China's a dictatorship. It seems to me that something could happen, whether it be, you know, Taiwan or Tiananmen Square, or Korea, who knows, but something could happen politically in China that could damage them economically in a way that, you know, Japan doesn't have to worry about.
Oh, I think you're absolutely right about that, because you know, the Chinese government actually keeps records of the number of demonstrations, and the number of demonstrations and, you know, sort of strikes and job actions has been increasing dramatically in recent years. There's a tremendous amount of discontent at the kinds of the intense exploitation a lot of Chinese workers experience. At the same time, there's this whole class of new rich. The polarization in China has been enormous. China has very, very, very serious environmental problems that could actually really impair the quality of life there in very, very serious ways. So something could go wrong in China, and the United States would be exposed, very badly exposed. That's where all our manufacturing capacity is, and that's where all the money is that we borrowed to keep going comes from. So if anything were to happen in China, and the party leadership is very worried about potential for instability coming from this kind of polarization and the social tensions that have come with it. The ecological problem is very, very serious, and they understand that. They've got some serious energy problems in China. So if anything went wrong there, we would be thrown for a tailspin. And that's one of the things that was so interesting about what happened on Wall Street.
I was just going to go there. I was going to say, if there's any doubt in your mind that China can cause real problems in America, just look at the hiccup in their stock market, and our Dow falls 400 points.
Yeah, because all these traders on Wall Street have all this in the back of their mind. They think, they understand the things that we've been talking about for the last better part of an hour, and they hear trouble in China, and they fill in the next four or five steps in the problem, and then they got scared, and correctly so. And today things are looking better. The Chinese recovered, some better news coming out of some companies, some better economic news coming out. So today was recovered, but it is a taste of what could happen. It could happen very, very quickly. And it's just like I keep
saying. The toll free number is 877-4 head on or 888-488 Mark. We've got a few minutes left if you want to call in and ask a question or make a comment to our esteemed guest. We'll be right back after this.
The United Brotherhood of Carpenters and Millwrights meet your most complex needs by providing productivity, competitiveness, reliability, accuracy, safety, leadership, and professionalism. Millwrights from the United Brotherhood of Carpenters are problem solvers. They accept any challenge and approach every project with the highest of competence and training. The UBC has thousands of professionals who can be at your service, giving you the best in business, anytime and every time. The Head On Radio Network is proud to be sponsored by these wonderful men and women who are building the American dream every day. Thank you from the Head On Radio Network.
Recently on the Guy James Show on the Head On Radio Network.
If you have tuned into this program by mistake right now, and you are a Republican, a right-wing Republican specifically, before this program is over, I do want to warn you, you're going to think that I'm the devil. You're going to think I've got horns and a red cape because I hate the Bush administration and everything they stand for. So be ye warned right away, okay? You're all warned right now that that's where we're coming from today.
Don't miss Guy James, weekdays, 3 to 5 Eastern Time, on the Head On Radio Network.
From Washington, more of the Inside Scoop with Mark Levine.
Welcome back to the Inside Scoop. Got about 6.5 minutes left with my wonderful guest. His name is Doug Henwood. He's the author of The New Economy, The Street, and The State of the USA Atlas. He's really quite informed, and we've been talking in detail about the state of the U.S. economy. It's not good. Let's try to end on a happier note if we can. Heck, we are Americans. That's what we do. We see the bright side even when there's not much of one there. Doug, what should we do? What should policymakers do? The Democratic Congress obviously has a lot of power. It's not in full control, but we certainly have more power as Democrats than we did 6 months ago. What can the Democratic Congress do to help the bottom 80%. I mean, what do you think about tax policies that tax the rich more and tax the poor less? Is that a good start?
I think that's a very good start. I think, you know, one of the most successful things the Clinton administration did was when they were first in office pushed through tax increases in the top 1% of the population. It had no depressive economic effect. If you raise taxes on middle and lower income people, it slows down demand and, you know, can hurt the economy. But that's not the case if you're just hitting the top 1%. And, you know, if the other 99% of the population can see his life getting better, it's a little political debt risk to just tax the top 1%. So that's one thing to do. I would see.
Let me ask you before you go to number two, what is the top 1%? We talk about it all the time, and I think a lot of people think they're in it, but they really aren't. Do you happen to know what that number is, what that income is for the top 1%?
Incomes of about $2 million a year.
$2 million a year.
Yeah.
Are in the top 1%. So if you're not earning $2 million a year, folks, you don't have to worry about our plan here.
Yeah.
If you are earning more than $2 million a year, then you know what? I think you can handle a little bit more taxes. It probably won't affect your lifestyle very much. You may have to go down to only 6 yachts this year instead of 7 yachts. But hey, we all have to tighten our belt a little bit. So that's really what we're talking about. $2 million in income or in wealth?
Something I discovered recently is that the richest 50,000 people in this country have combined incomes greater than the poorest 45 million. So there's a lot of money up there at the top.
Okay. What else can we do?
A serious increase in the minimum wage would be nice.
It's coming, but the Democrats passed it in the House. In the Senate, the Republicans filibustered it. Instead, we gave those tax breaks for businesses that we have to give because, you know, we can't just give, an inflation increase for poor people that's, you know, standard of living type thing. We've got to throw in some new stuff for businesses, too.
Yeah, you know, the real value of the minimum wage today is lower than it was in the mid-1950s. So, you know, taking the minimum wage back to its purchasing power of the mid-1950s doesn't seem so radical to me.
So why is it that Americans aren't mad at the Republicans for filibustering in the Senate and forcing more debt, because that's what it is, folks, it's more debt to give to businesses. And after all, what's a tax cut? A tax cut is a permanent dollar gift. I mean, you know, you pay a certain amount of taxes each year, and then you get less each year. That's every single year you get more just to get the minimum wage back up to where it was for inflation. I mean, why aren't they indexing the minimum wage so that goes up every year? And businesses, let them rely on the Republican Congress.
Well, polls show that this has strong support. Not only the increase in the minimum wage, but indexing it to inflation has supported the 70% range in the polls. But
they're not even talking about that.
And I don't know, people just can't make the connection between who they vote for and the policies that are implemented. I just don't get it, really. But
let me suggest to everyone, when you call your senator and you call your congressman, don't just ask for an increase in minimum wage, but ask to be indexed for inflation so we don't have to wait 10 years to get this kind of thing. Listen, congressmen's wages are indexed for inflation. You think they get it? Why can't the poorest people in America have theirs indexed as well? Just remember, folks, don't just ask for minimum wage, but ask for that indexing. It's a really important thing.
Yeah, indexing it to the congressional wage might be a nice thing.
So, ooh, that would be very nice.
Yes.
that's a great idea, Doug. I hadn't thought about that.
Stay on Wall Street.
I like that. Incentives, right? Incentivizing people for the right idea. What else can we do?
I'd like to see better labor law, make it easier to organize a union. Employers constantly fire people who try to organize a union, use all kinds of other hardball tactics.
What is going on with unions? I mean, 20, 30, 50 years ago even, unions were far more powerful than they are today. Why aren't people bonding together and protecting their wages like they did 20, 30 years ago?
It's very, very hard, for one. The law is so stacked against anybody trying to organize a union. You know, polls show people would like to join unions. Many people would like to join unions, but it's just so hard to organize one here.
Is it harder than it was 20 years ago?
Oh, yeah. Employers are much more aggressive than they ever were before. Remember, you know, when Reagan fired the air traffic controllers, it used to be just not done. It was certainly legal to do that sort of thing, but just employers didn't do that sort of thing. You didn't fire workers who were on strike, but then Reagan gave them license to do that. Just looked like there was open warfare on organized labor. At the present rate of decline, unions are going to disappear in this country sometime around 2030. So It's not a good situation, but it...
Let me ask you one more question, Doug. Whenever I argue exactly what you and I are talking about with Republicans, and like I said, I do that, my listeners know, once a week, I always try to debate someone on my right to keep them on their toes. They'll say things like, well, you know, these folks, the CEOs, they earned the money, and they should be able to keep the money they earned. I don't know. It's a lot of rhetoric, I think, but how do you respond to someone who says things like that?
Well, you know, we had economic performance in the 50s and 60s was much better in most ways than it is now, and CEOs weren't making anything near the kinds of money they do today. We have economists sometimes call a winner-take-all society. The people at the very top are making more money than ever, and everyone else is just scraping to get by. And you know, at the very, very top, it's less than the top 1% who are really pulling it in these days. And you know, it's great for them, but the rest of us, there's not much to show for it. So I don't understand what they're doing for the rest of us that makes it justify that they pull down these enormous salaries. You know, why the top three execs at Goldman Sachs got bonuses of over $50 million apiece?
I think part of it is the difference between Americans and Europeans. I lived in Europe for a year, and I think in Europe people care about their overall society, not just themselves and their families, but their country and the people around them just a lot more than Americans do. I think in some ways we're a very selfish people, and maybe that's that self-reliant Western image that we have. But maybe it's just a little, we don't have some of the compassion that...
Yeah, I think, you know, we have a society that's long been dominated by this ideology of competitive individualism. And that has just been intensified in the last 25, 30 years.
Doug Henwood, thank you very much for coming here on The Inside Scoop. As I mentioned, he's the author of The New Economy, The Street, The State of the USA Atlas. Go to my website, radioinsidescoop.com. Take a peek at his books, download them, and maybe even pay him a little bit on PayPal. We're doing sort of a twofer this week. Today we focus on the super rich. Tomorrow on the super poor. We're focusing on poverty in America. Who are the poor? Why is poverty the highest in more than 30 years? And what can we do to alleviate the pain? My guest is the Director of Poverty, Education, and Social Justice at the Institute for Women's Policy Research. But for now, this is Mark Levine signing off.
America's number one Democratic talk show. You've heard from the radical right. Now, all that's left is the truth. And now here's Guy James.
Hello there, everybody. This is the Guy James Show coming to you live from the beautiful blue waters and sandy beaches of Southwest Florida. Glad to have you all of you along with us today on this live version of the Guy James Show here on a Wednesday afternoon. Yes, indeed, it is Wednesday. So glad to have all of you along. Hello to all of you folks over at iTunes. My word, we've been getting a great response from the people at the iTunes site. So glad to have you aboard and welcome. We hope you'll join us every day. We hope you'll check in on the other programs on the Head On Radio Network. And we appreciate you learning. We've got a lot on tap for you today. As you know, one of the big stories of the day yesterday was the huge drop in the stock market, 416 points down. There have been various explanations for why it happened. Some of it is attributed to a electronic glitch they said they had, and others, we'll talk about it just a little bit later. We've got a gentleman by the name of Dean Baker. He's the co-director of the Center of Economic and Policy Research, and he'll be joining us from Washington coming up in, about 15 minutes or so. So we'll be ready to talk about that and the economic condition of the United States right now. And there's reason to believe that we may be headed for trouble. Alan Greenspan has been talking the dirty word recession. I think many of us have been forecasting that for a while now. I don't know what the official... And let me be clear here. I'm not an economist. But like many of you, I do keep track of the forces that do drive our economy. And I see some red flags on the horizon. So we'll be talking about that coming up in just a few minutes. A variety of things to talk about today. And we do hope you'll join us here on the program. And you can do so by giving us a call at 866-546-5254. That's 866-546-5254 if you'd like to join us on the program. And as we mentioned yesterday, we're instituting some new rules here on the show. Not a rule, it's a request, really, since we don't screen our calls. You go live on the air when you're here, and that's nothing but trouble for a lot of radio hosts. But we take our chances here since we don't have to worry about FCC rules. And we ask that you stick to the topic that we're talking about, unless we're declaring it an open mic day where you can say anything you like and talk about anything you want. But if we're on a subject and you call, we hope you'll stay on the subject. Okay? That's not too much to ask. And also, no more than one call per day. Well, it is... February 28th, the very last day of February, this not being leap year. Of course, we did hear Mr. Bush last week talk about, let's hear Mr. Bush again here.
5 years ago, this day, September the 11th, was seared into America's memory.
Well.
No, look out, look out!
Today we were safer.
This is not the one we thought.
Not yet safe.
Help me! Somebody help me!
For America, 9/11 was more than a tragedy. It changed the way we look at the world.
Mashed potatoes, gravy, and cranberry sauce.
That's not the cut we were looking for. We don't know what happened to it. One of the little computer monsters came up and got it, evidently. But we were talking about a speech which Mr. Bush gave last week. Where